I am very happy to present Lisa Powell, Early Childhood Consultant and Biting Specialist. Welcome, Lisa.
Hi, happy to be here.
Thank you so much. And before we start, can you please tell us a bit about yourself and what you do?
Yes. I have been working with parents and teachers, caregivers for over 30 years now. I started out as a preschool teacher. I have a degree in early childhood education and then a graduate degree in human development. And my main focus over the years has been the age group 0 through 3 years old. And my specialization in biting just came out of so many times I'd been asked to consult on children who were fighting. 1-year-olds, 2-year-olds, occasionally a 3-year-old. I've worked for various agencies. I've worked for independently for myself for many years. And I found that I had chances to observe children and then work through the identification of the reasons and come up with some very workable solutions for people. I work in New York City directly with families, but I also work remotely with people all over the country, which works as well. You know, people find me usually from my website, Stop the Fighting and Biting, or through my book, The Biting Solution. And in both of those places, it says, please contact me directly if you want more customized support. And sometimes people will do that. And then that's what we do.
That's so awesome. And I love that you have specialized in biting because it's oftentimes a behavior that we see a lot of in toddlerhood. And before we dive into biting specifically, I'd like to ask you, what do you feel makes toddlerhood a challenging and oftentimes misunderstood developmental period?
Yeah, it's a tricky time for parents because toddlers are just so new at everything, right? They're still fairly new in the world. And so they're confused about a lot of things. And they look like they're more grown up than they are. They're learning to walk and run and talk. And they're eating table foods. And, you know, so they give you the impression that they're more mature than really they are socially and emotionally. And I don't think, you know, a lot of people don't have experience working with infants and toddlers. They may, you know, have more experience working with preschoolers and school-age children, but toddlers are their own unique age group. Another thing that's tricky, I think, with toddlers is that if they're in a group care situation, they're with another group of toddlers similar to themselves that are also, a whole bunch of them are confused and trying to figure out intentions of other people. And, you know, if you watch a room full of toddlers, you see a lot of very random moving people and people that are like on a beeline to get a toy, or there's a freneticness sometimes about it that is just very natural for the age. But we need to be sensitive to the toddler's point of view and their perspective that it's confusing to them. And so they require a lot of, I think, interpretation from adults about what's happening in their life. the other thing that's tough with toddlers is they're just naturally very curious and stimulated by their surroundings and really driven to try new things, touch new things. And again, when they're with other children, that will turn into grabbing, again, very normal for the age period, but that can often lead to some defensiveness, which in some cases, that's biting.
Yeah, absolutely. And you make a lot of good points because really, there's so much discovery happening in toddlerhood. And so toddlers are discovering what it means to be them, and they learn that from how their environment interacts with them. They learn that from making interpretations from what's happening in their environment. So you're right, it does a lot come from the caregivers and adults in their life is what toddlers are learning about themselves and making interpretations from. And you know, I always say the job of the toddler is experimenting and exploration. Those are the two main jobs of toddlerhood, which, you know, just really encompass that curiosity and discovery.
Right. And I think we want to, you know, promote that. We don't want to squelch that at all. And they're such concrete learners at this age, and they don't really understand abstract concepts like be nice to people. That's very abstract. The word share is very abstract. I mean, I think people sometimes forget that they really operate on a moment by moment basis in a concrete world.
Yeah, that's so true. And so shifting towards biting, I'm curious, why do you feel biting is such a common behavior that we see in toddlerhood?
You know, I think they're still very sensory oriented. So it's very, they're sort of just automatically, you know, using their mouth to test the world, figure things out. Most toddlers will go through what I call garden variety biting, where they may follow through on an urge to bite and then very quickly give it up and turn to some other way of handling their stressor of the moment. Some children get hooked on a biting reaction for a variety of reasons, and it's a little bit of a mystery at first until you unravel what those reasons are. I would say frequent biting is when the reaction to lots of different stressors is bite. That's the first thing out the gate. And it may not even have to do with a trigger. It may not have to do with someone's grabbing my toy or somebody sitting on my parent's lap. You know, it's like there are reasons for it that sometimes elude parents. And the thing I've heard from parents and teachers, if I had a nickel for every time I heard he bit for no reason, I mean, I would just be a rich, rich woman, because that's very frequently the confounding part of dealing with a biter, because it looks like they weren't even provoked and they did it.
Would you say that that's one of the common misconceptions that parents and caregivers have about biting?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Are there any other ones that kind of pop up that are common misconceptions when it comes to toddlers and biting?
Mm-hmm. Usually people think that there's something deficient in the child, that it's their fault. And in my opinion, it's really not their fault. There's something going on that the adults need to attend to, need to change, need to insert, need to do differently. And another misconception is that a toddler really cares and understands about how another child feels. And that's empathy. And, you know, it takes a while in our development to get to a stage of true empathy. First, you'll see even an infant start feeling compassion in their face when they notice somebody's upset. Then the next sort of developmental stage is then they feel sympathy. They might bring you a Kleenex if you're crying. But empathy is different. Empathy is when a child or another person can put themselves in your place and understand what you're feeling separate from what I'm feeling. And that doesn't happen with two-year-olds generally, in my experience. It's more a preschool kind of ability. So when a person says, like, why did you bite him? Look how it made him feel. That's not going to change the biting very much. You may say that, but, you know, people expect that to make a big difference. I'll tell you another thing that I find a misconception is that if a child has been bitten, the adult was standing too far away. And for any of us who've been with toddlers, you know that it can happen right under your nose. It can happen right next to you because, you know, your reach might be, I don't know, 24 inches, but that child standing right next to another child, if they just lean over 6 inches, they can bite another child on the shoulder, on the cheek, on the finger. It's very, very hard to stop a bite, even if it's right next to you.
Yeah, that is
to prevent it, but like really stopping it, you're just lucky if you put your arm in there in the right moment to prevent it, and it's that close.
Yeah, it happens in like a blink of an eye.
In the blink of an eye.
Yes.
Absolutely. To the best of us.
Exactly. So what do you feel really drives the urge for kids to bite? I know you mentioned that, especially toddlers, that it's partially sensory oriented and partially stressors. Can you just elaborate a little bit more on that drive?
I think the drive, though, comes from what I talk about in my practice and in my book and my work is I found 7 different reasons why children fall into biting. I mean, physically they have that sensory urge to put everything in their mouth and, you know, that sort of thing. That just kind of goes without saying. But the reason it turns into a hurtful behavior, an action like that, you know, it has to do with these 7 reasons we talked about. I mean, we can go into more detail here, but essentially I can just like rattle them off for you. It's stage of development. It's maybe something in their previous experience or a recent change in their life. It may have to do with their verbal skills. It may have to do with their physical condition. You know, their fatigue, their hunger. I've seen clients, constipation was a factor in a child's, crankiness and not able to handle stressors. Temperament is a big factor in why some children end up biting and others don't. Physical environment, the way of the setting, you know, how it's designed, how much space there is. Is there crowding? Is it overstimulating, understimulating? What's happening in the environment? That's the easiest thing to fix, actually. And limit setting. There are children that even by 15, 18 months old, they've experienced some limit setting at home or out of the home, which is working against them in terms of learning not to do this. And so you have to sort of tease out those. You have to ask these questions and then figure out, all right, in this case, it's temperament, physical condition, and limit setting. Or in this case, it's, oh, he had a previous experience and da-da-da and da-da-da and da-da. That's what we're going to focus on. And so there's no real silver bullet. There's no real one size fits all on this issue. And that's why people get frustrated, because they can say, like, I have a whole room of kids, 10 of them are not biting, and 2 of them are. What is wrong with those 2 kids? Why can't they be like these other 10? Well, these 2 kids, there's something in those 7 questions that's creating a little bit of a perfect storm. And sometimes it's, you know, well, all the time, it's a combination of what's happening at home and what's happening in the group situation. And there are changes to be made on both sides. And when those changes are super consistent, then voila, you know, the child learns other ways to manage those strong feelings.
And I think that's one of the frustrating parts about being a caregiver and a parent is that, you know, we would love to have this silver bullet or this solution that works for everyone all the time. Not even in parenting and caregiving, but I mean, in other aspects of life. And, you know, the fact of the matter is that we're all unique individuals. And so there is going to be, everything is multifaceted, and there's going to be a lot of different reasons why something's happening. And so what I'm hearing is that these 7 reasons that you gave really drive the habit of biting. It's like these are the things that sometimes get off kilter that are part of the puzzle. They're the puzzle pieces that really are behind a habit of biting.
Yeah, and you don't know what it is yet unless you observe the child in you know, a play setting and you talk about how are things handled at home? How are things handled outside the home? There are certain things that, you know, people are doing that unintentionally reinforce biting also. And they don't know that because they don't know that. But there's a whole slew of things that people can just stop doing or do a little bit differently that will make a big difference.
And before we go a little bit further, like getting into some of the things that unintentionally reinforce biting, I also would like to just draw a contrast between experimenting with biting and then biting becoming a habit, because I think it can be helpful for parents and caregivers to draw a contrast between the two, because it is very normal early on in toddlerhood for toddlers to experiment with biting. So can you just elaborate on that experimentation versus biting becoming a habit?
Yeah.
Because I think it's important to draw that contrast.
I agree. And a lot of times babies, 9-month-old, 10-month-old, 12-month-old, you know, and young toddlers will bite like a playful love bite, like a puppy bite. Like they're so excited. They're just so thrilled, you know, about something that they bite, and they don't make a distinction either. I mean, we're kissing babies all the time. We don't put our teeth on them. We kiss them, but they can't see the difference. What's the difference? They can't see the difference. Sometimes parents will confuse children and play biting games. Like, I'm going to eat up your tummy. I'm going to eat your toes. And if a child has become a frequent biter, I'll always ask the parents, don't play biting games because it's confusing. If you want to kiss a child, say, I'm going to kiss you with my lips so that they understand the distinction. Again, it's that concrete thinking. You know, children will bite just because there's energy behind their emotion. And that's normal. I mean, when you nurse a baby, they'll bite you because they're feeling emotional. And they don't understand that that's crossing a line, that's a hurtful thing. And so when you have a child that's just doing that normal kind of biting, you put them down and say, I don't like that. I won't let you bite me. You know, we only touch people gently. So if you're going to say, don't do something, tell them what to do. We kiss people with our lips like this. We only touch people gently like this. So you have to give them a different path. You can't just say, don't do that. That's not nice. Bad boy. You know, you never say bad boy, bad girl. And so this distinction of I won't let you hurt me is a very important tool, I think, for parents, because you want to establish, like, I'm drawing the line. It's an accident. You didn't understand, but here's where the line is. Mm-hmm. And it's not like you're overreacting in a punitive way. You just have to be clear.
Yeah, because, you know, it really comes from this experimentation and exploration that, you know, the young toddlers don't yet know the expectations in all the different situations and with all the different actions. And they're also, what I've seen also is that they're realizing they have control over their body and that their body is powerful. So they're also experimenting with like all the things their body can do and the power of their body.
Yeah, exactly. And it's you know, enthusing. It's, you know, it's fabulous. But, you know, but slowly by surely they're learning limits on certain things. You know, they're not being allowed to jump on the couch. They're not being allowed to be in the car without being in their car seat. They have to sit in the shopping cart with a little seatbelt on in the shop. You know, there are certain things that you ask them to do that you just start setting limits. And that's just, it's just one of them, that we don't put our teeth on people. That's one of the many limits they are learning.
Yeah, that they're learning. And so then when some of these different, these seven reasons kind of get out of kilter, there's something else going on. This is when biting becomes a habit in reaction to a stressor and moves away from the experimentation. And so what I'd like to ask are, what are some of the responses that parents and caregivers have that unintentionally reinforce biting? Because of course, in all of these moments, we're doing the best that we can, you know, in any moment, and especially ones that are stressful, like biting, we're in our own stress response at times. So, you know, of course, everyone's doing the best that they can. And there are some responses that can reinforce the biting. And so can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Well, I think that, like you said, the thing that comes up is shock for parents. Like, oh my gosh, it's like, it's a huge, embarrassing, scary thing when a child does that to another child or even yourself. And so we have to try to keep it in perspective that this is a toddler behavior that is not out of the ordinary. And it just, it's a call to action for us. Well, there are many things. I mean, scolding and shaming and using harsh discipline, I guess I would start by saying that is not useful at all. And you wanna be your child's coach in your reaction to biting. You don't wanna be the, you know, warden. You wanna help them understand, you cross the line, whoops, let me explain how this works to you. In your presence to them. You want to stay calm. You don't want to have something happen and it's like the drama button gets pushed and the adult freaks out. You have to be the one in control because the little situation here is out of control. You don't want to ignore it. You know, I always say if a child attempts to bite another child, don't just wipe your brow and say, good, dodged a bullet. You know, you want to say, whoops, now I need to step in, have a little moment, do a reminder coaching with this, with the toddler, because it would have been a bite had it not been caught in time. People sometimes will ask a child to make an apology. Like, let's say you have an 18-month-old that bit somebody, and the adult will say, you know, you need to say you're sorry. That wasn't nice. Let's go get some ice. You need to put ice on the person you just hurt. What happens there, Devin, is it becomes, now I'm part of the, now it's a reward. Now I'm very, the child is very involved in the whole situation and it feels like a benefit to the bite. So you don't want them to be in the middle of the circus. You want them to be like, I can't let you near people when you bite. Sit here while I get some ice for so-and-so. Now we need to talk. And sorry is just way too abstract for a toddler. You know, if you want them to say something at the end of the coaching, you might say, are you all done biting? And if the toddler says yes, maybe they don't even say anything. You would say, I think you're all done biting. You want to power positive thinking. You want to show confidence that they're going to learn other ways, right? I run into a lot of people, for some reason over the last few years, this phrase has become more prevalent where a parent or a teacher will say, somebody will do something wrong and they will say to the child, no, thank you. Have you heard that?
Yes, yes.
No, thank you, Mason. And it's such an oxymoron. Poor little Mason, you know, he's like, in his head, he's thinking, what is it, no or thank you? This is not about manners. This is about, like, somebody was feeling stressed. They made the wrong choice. What's a better direction to go in? Give me some ideas. Don't tell me no, thank you, as if that's it's a veiled bad boy is what it is. It's a veiled shaming statement.
Yeah. It's true. And like, that's the thing that it's, as humans, one way that we discern our environment is by putting labels on things, you know, by labeling, it's one way that we discern and understand things. And so there is that natural desire to put labels on a child's behavior. But those labels are counteractive to the end goal and what you're actually trying to achieve with a child. Even though it's a natural urge for us as humans to put these labels, so it really takes practice. So thanks for pointing out and showing how these labels can get hidden in other actions.
Yeah, exactly. And it doesn't, it's not a deterrent. You know, if you say to a child, you know, how would you like someone to do that to you? Or, you know, what if I were to bite your arm? How do you think that would feel? That is not a deterrent. Many people think that it is. And it, again, you're asking the child to do higher order thinking and have empathy and, you know, and that's not working for this age group. Mm-hmm. I would say another thing people do is children get crowded unintentionally. Sometimes I'll be asked to observe a child who's been biting in a group situation, and I'll say, well, where does this happen? And they'll say, oh, oftentimes, you know, on the carpet when they're having story time or at the table during snack time. And what I find out is they're very crowded and they don't give the children enough room for their boundaries, for their bodies, for their space bubble. Sometimes it happens at transitions where people are all of a sudden ignoring the children because they have housekeeping duties, or I'm washing somebody's hands, or somebody's diapers need changing. And then you have 10 children fending for themselves, but they're only 23 months old. You know, that's hard for them. They're going to be crowded or asked to line up or asked to wait for something without a focus. That unintentionally will reinforce hurtful behavior.
Yes, and this really brings up a great point, is that biting, this action, this behavior, all behavior is a form of communication. So yeah. This example that you just gave really illustrates how in this situation, biting is communicating, I need personal space, you know, for this child that's feeling crowded in circle time. And so it's really interesting to remember that even biting is a form of communication that's signaling another message, that it's not about the behavior. It's the manifestation of something else that's happening. It's an expression of something else.
That's right. That's right. And if you're going to be a good coach and you're going to step in after a biting situation, you want to do two things. You know, getting back to the word, you know, you don't want to say to a child who's just learning to talk, use your words. You want to actually give them the word that would have worked in that situation. So like if it's crowding and a child has bitten, then part of your coaching needs to be, I know he made you upset because he pushed against you or you felt crowded, and that's a hard thing to feel. Next time, tell him, move. Move. Even a 17-month-old can say, move. Older children can learn to say, move over, give me space, too close. You know, what are the words that they need to have at the tip of their tongue in the heat of the moment?
Yes.
That's our job, to teach them those words, because they don't know automatically what words to pull out of the air. And if you just say to a 2-year-old, use your words, you're wasting your breath.
Mm-hmm.
You're wasting your breath.
It's so true, because whenever we come into these moments, we're coming from the adult logical brain. And so a lot of times, because, you know, we're busy, we have our own agenda, we have a lot going on. So a lot of times when we arrive at the scene, it's coming from the adult logical approach, where in that are assumptions that children know what to do and they're just ignoring it, being bad and not doing it. But really what it's showing is a child's having trouble meeting an expectation, and one way of getting them to meet the expectation in that moment, which in this specific example is, you know, describing what they need, is giving them the words to do it. And it's a step that we oftentimes forget, because we're coming from that logical place in our own brains, which is very normal as adults, as humans.
Yeah, and we've learned over the years how to cope with feelings of panic, feelings of stress, feelings of being crowded on the subway, feelings of being hungry. you know, without falling apart. But when you're a little guy and it's, you know, you're 1 or 2 years old or 3 years old, you know, you're operating pretty close to the surface on how you handle your feelings. And number one, you don't even know what you are feeling because nobody's taught you that you're feeling worried or impatient or upset, that you don't have a word to pin on that. And I'm always talking to people about use nuanced feelings. When you're stepping in to talk to a child about a situation that went wrong, say to them, you know, I understand you're so disappointed. Your blocks fell when he walked by. He did accidentally knocked him over, and how disappointing that must be for you. I won't let you hurt him. Here's how you can handle your feeling. And, you know, you teach them a couple of little things that they can do in the heat of the moment when you're not even there. A couple of my favorites are to talk to children, even young children, about, like, you know, your standard take a deep breath model, which is take a deep breath, blow it out. That'll help you feel better. I know it's hard to feel so angry when you feel that way. Take a deep breath, blow it out is one suggestion. Another one that I've seen work for a lot of toddlers who bite is when you say, I won't let you bite people, but when you feel really angry, you can clench your teeth and breathe in and out like that through your teeth. And they like that because it's a very strong sound. And it takes a lot of energy, actually, to breathe in and out through your teeth. So it's venting, you know. I have had a lot of clients where they say, ah, like that becomes the like vent sound that they do. Instead of biting, I feel like biting, ah! And then they say, don't, or mine, or stop, or help. But oftentimes they can't get a word, they can't pull that word out yet without a little bit of a physical something. And if you can think of a physical something they can do with their jaw, with their mouth, then you're really talking the language of the biter. That's where they're feeling the tension. And so if you vent the tension here, then you're helping them to get centered and to be able to control that urge. You really, really are. And they don't even need to have any words. I've seen, you know, 15-month-olds do this, 17-month-olds do this. And then other children know that, oops, they're, you know, they're pretty angry about something, pretty frustrated. It gives everybody a moment of warning too.
Absolutely. And
by the way, let me just mention one thing. Mm-hmm. Adults do this all the time. We all still do it. It's just a human thing. Where if you're mad about something, it's, you know, how many people just go, ah, or, you know, it's like, you know, you make some kind of like something with your body. You don't just walk right into like, I'm very frustrated about blah, 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 blah. No, you have a moment where you can feel that energy in your body and it goes somewhere. You put it somewhere.
Yeah, because if you don't put it somewhere and you just shove it down, it's going to come back up later. So it has to go somewhere. Well, I mean, it doesn't have to, but eventually it will go somewhere. So we can actually choose to put it somewhere, or we can stuff it away and then it pops up when we least expect it and goes somewhere on its own.
Yeah, and if you get a child to stop biting, but you don't teach them any other skills of how to deal with their feelings and emotions, you know what happens? It just morphs into scratching, and it morphs into hitting, and morphs into, you know, other behaviors that you're now going to have to fix that too.
Yeah, it's so true. And it's so funny. You took the words right out of my mouth. First I want to say thanks for giving us these coping skills because they're really important. And they also apply to adults because we're all humans, even, you know, toddlers, we treat them like, you know, they don't know much or they're insignificant. But, you know, the reason this works is that for us to be able to be more rational or to think clearly, we need to come out of the stress response, whether we're 2 years old or we're 200 years old. That's how it works. And that these, by choosing how to offload those feelings and emotions in a very specific, positive way, create space from them, which then allows then to move on to more rational thinking and taking a step forward that is, you know, allowing us to not blow up, or in this case for a child, not bite.
Right, exactly. One of the things that I put on my website is something that I call, I'll show you, the Instructive Intervention Guide. And people can just download it. It's like a quick little one-page handout. And it follows what we're talking about. It's on page, I think, 21 of the book. And it's exactly what we're saying with some more examples. And if you're going to talk to a toddler about the word to use in the situation, even if they're excited when they bite, some children are not mad about anything. Nobody's grabbing from them. They don't want anything you're holding. But I had a client last year who's a 2.5-year-old, and when people would come in to the space, he would run up to them and be so excited to see them, he would chomp them. And so the teachers, you know, decided, like, we got to give them an alternative thing to do that's strong and exciting. And so they taught him how to fling his hands up like this and say, hey, when he saw people enter the room, hey. And that kept him from, it just turned him from the biting impulse.
Yeah.
And it worked. It worked.
It's so powerful, because this is what it comes down to. When we see a lot of these challenging behaviors, or behaviors that we might label as aggressive, it's, you know, kids are communicating something. And as you said, there's a lot of energy behind it. And oftentimes they just need a different way to express their emotions in a physical way, because, you know, they're expressing something, how they're feeling, in a very physical way. So the key is to give them a way to express it that fits within our expectations and boundaries as the adults. And so thank you for giving this great example, because I work in my coaching practice, I work with parents on this with all different types of behaviors and things. And so thank you for this very specific example around biting, because it really shows the power of how you can create a win-win situation out of something challenging, because it's within the adult's expectations and boundaries, and it helps the kids express their emotions in a physical way. And toddlers are extremely physical because they're constantly learning through movement. So that's why they need that physical outlet.
Sometimes when we talk about this, a parent will go back to sort of a classic example of punching a pillow. Oh, I guess I need to bring him over to a pillow and eat a punch. No, you have to think of something he can do standing right there in the moment, not going anywhere, in his body right now. It's something that, that you can just a little release. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is, some children fall into this category more than others. And I'm a big believer in individual differences in temperament, and that people are born with these 9 different temperamental traits. And studies started on this back in the 1950s and have been replicated and replicated and replicated until now. We know that certain children are just more intense than others in the expression of their emotions. Certain children are more active than others. Certain children are more persistent about, like, what they are persistent about their idea than others. Those are some of the children I see a lot of who become frequent biters. And sometimes those are the children that are tough to parent because of that. Because when they have a temper tantrum, number one, it lasts a long time. It's loud in volume. It's very expressive. You know, that's your intense, high intense, high persistence kind of child. And maybe they're also overstimulated easily by visual things, or, you know, and maybe also they had ear infections when they were an infant. And so they spent a lot of their first year not hearing properly. So though that's what I mean about these different things come into play, where a child now is going to need, that child will need more coaching because they're a bit behind the eight ball on certain things. The ear infections is an important one I want to mention, because it comes up so much, and I feel like people are, they need to respect the fact that when a child is having an ear infection, they're really in a sort of a bubble. They're really underwater, and they're that much more confused about people's actions around them. And so they get hyper defensive, because it's almost like people are sneaking up behind me. I can't hear them properly, and oop, there they are. And I can't even tell you the number of strong biting cases, people maybe that attempt to bite 10 times a day. And when I ask, how many ear infections did this child have as an infant or toddler? The number is maybe 10. That's a lot. That's a lot of time you spent underwater not being able to really hear properly what's going on around you. And that creates a nervousness that now that they have tubes, now they're better, they're starting to learn words. You know, that's all well and good, but their perception of other people and other toddlers is going to be different than someone who didn't have that as a stressor. And so they'll need more coaching to overcome that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And I can, I want to thank you for starting to kind of touch on the seven reasons that biting happens that are, you know, kind of behind and driving biting. And I'm curious, how can parents and caregivers identify these things? So what's the process in starting to identify these seven things and like what is at play and you know how do they use this identification to help stop a child from biting?
Yeah. The method I use and again the materials are on the site on the website is really ask the seven questions you need to ask at home and in any care situation. And especially the limit setting question, which is the last question. What kind of limit setting happens with this child? When this child has a tantrum, what do you do? When this child wants something, what do you do? When this child steps over a limit and hurts someone, what do you do? That has to be examined because if you're unintentionally making it worse by your response, then that will get in the way of this child learning the new techniques you want him to learn. And I always find that's an area that can be improved upon. A lot of times these kids that are highly temperamental, there's also a temperament questionnaire that you'll find on my site. And if you do the questionnaire so that you and your spouse, you and your caregivers understand, oh, he really is on the high end of intensity. Oh, he is really on the low end of adaptability. He really is on the high end of, whatever it is, then you feel better about like, all right, it's not like you need to take him for an evaluation on something. Let's just look at this is a child with a particular set of characteristics. And that's why it's going to take a little bit more intentionality to teach him better ways to manage stressors. The other thing is, if you have a child who's like physical condition, you say, what's this physical condition like in the morning? And I always like to say, well, let's talk about when he eats and when he bites. And sometimes there's a correlation. In fact, there are studies that show that children bite most frequently in the late morning. And that's because they're starting to run out of steam. They're starting to get hungry. There's a lot of transitioning going on. People are getting things set out. Maybe you're running errands out, in the world, and you're kind of stretching your child's ability to hang in there with you. And they have meltdowns. So you want to back up in time and say, all right, maybe I can improve by making sure he has a very good breakfast that's going to be satiating, not Rice Krispies, satiating breakfast. That's going to get him through to snack. That's going to get him through to lunchtime. I ask parents about thirst. How does your child relate to water? Some people will say, she's really thirsty. She's dying of thirst when I pick her up from school. To me, that's an indicator of, all right, there's an area we can work on. You ask the provider, offer her water every hour. Have a little sports bottle or something that you can just offer her water every hour. Anything you can do to take away a stressor, do it. You just have to identify those stressors and then take them away, and then you insert the helpful language and the tools, polishing up your limit setting skills. But the easiest, the way to start is, and what I ask people to do is fill out this little action plan. On the left-hand column, you'll see, here are the things that relate to my child regarding these seven questions. On the right-hand column is, and here are the things we can do to fix that. And in the book, for example, there is like a little checklist on, if your issue is speech and language, here are some things you can do to fix that. If your issue is temperament, here are some things you can do to help in that. So it's like very kind of a practical point of view. Parents don't need to get all panicky. There's lots and lots they can do themselves at home and caregivers, you know, in a group setting. Does that give you some?
Yeah, that's really great.
The process.
Yeah, that's great. You know, the process is going through the identifying and then seeing, okay, from there, like, okay, which of the reasons are at play here? And then really what I heard is identifying, okay, what do we have control over in terms of these things? And I think that that's what really can drive the momentum. And that's why like this worksheet that you're talking about can be so helpful, because a lot of times when parents are getting flustered or feeling scared and, you know, really just getting really nervous and anxious about a behavior, it's because it feels so out of control. So by first going through and identifying which factors are at play, and then identifying which aspects of the factors we actually have control over, I think it's surprising to find out that we honestly have more control over certain factors than we might have previously thought. And then that in turn, as the feeling of control goes up, then the feeling of anxiety and stress goes down. So it sounds like this worksheet can be very helpful part of the process in getting parents from one place to another in terms of biting.
Right. And then you have a little plan that you can share with anybody who's working with this child, whether it's the grandma or the, you know, babysitter or the teacher or the spouse. You know, everybody can sort of say, like, here's why we think it's happening and here's what we're doing about it. And, you know, it's little things too. It's like sometimes it has to do with picking the child up a little earlier, or at home, if it's happening too a lot at home, it has to do with like, maybe bedtime is too late. Maybe they're less capable of handling normal stressors because they really should be put into bed a half hour earlier. Or, you know, it kind of will inform your parenting decisions.
Mm-hmm.
It should. Yeah. And when it does, then you can solve this very quickly.
And I'm curious, what is like the overarching key for parents to remember? If there's like one takeaway or like one really big thing to remember about toddlers and biting, what would that be?
I would say the big takeaway is that this is not the child's fault. The actions that have to be taken rest with the adults. And once the adults realize how to change their response and the way they're removing stressors, and then the advice they're giving the child, if it's good advice, you know, that is specific to the incident, then the child understands and they learn. I call it, I you know, sometimes I'll talk to parents and I'll say, you know what work where you're analyzing something and you're doing a gap analysis, you're trying to find, you know, what's missing. It's like that. You have to do a gap analysis for a biting situation and say, what is he not understanding? What is he reacting to? How can I fill that gap with what my child needs? And it may be that you have to learn some new techniques and you have to not rely on just what comes out of your mouth instantly, what's habit or what your, you know, cousin, how she raises her kids. You have to really say to yourself, this is a customized situation and I need to read my child. And then I have to be thoughtful about being intentional in managing this, because it's manageable. And that's why I wrote the book, because I feel like, you know what, you don't need an expert to come in and do this. You can learn this if you just take it step by step and are consistent. And it won't work if people aren't consistent. Because what happens too, can I just say one more last piece of advice? I'm giving you like seven. But intermittent reinforcement is your worst enemy. So if you say to yourself, yes, I'm going to be different about how I step in and intervene, and then sometimes you let it go, sometimes you step in, sometimes you let it go, well, that's intermittent reinforcement. They're going to keep pushing that limit because sometimes it goes down. Sometimes you cave. And so it takes some concerted effort on the part of the adults.
Yeah, and a lot of practice.
Coaching, here I'm coaching again. I got to coach again.
Right. It takes a lot of practice to move away from the warden or the enforcer and to the coach, into that role. And what I call it in my coaching practice is the leader and guide, stepping into the role of the leader and guide. It's the same thing though, but this is how I call it in my practice. And it does take a lot of practice on parents' part. And I think oftentimes there's an expectation that for parents and caregivers that I give it an effort one or two times, and there's this expectation that then it should be mastered or it should be perfect.
Oh, that doesn't work.
It should all work out. And it's like, oh, wait, there's a learning curve. It takes practice. But a lot of times that initial sense of failure can really deter people. And then, you know, you give up because we just expect to get from A to Z in one leap and not, you know, hit all the stepping stones along the way, which is the practice.
Right. I always say to people, you know, give it about 10 days to 2 weeks. If you should see remarkable improvement if you are working your action plan properly. And if you don't, read it again because there's something you're not being consistent about or there's something you've missed.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's a pretty quick turnaround.
Yeah. So it's really about
a learning curve. It's not going to happen in 3 days.
No, not for yourself and not for the child either. It's just not possible. We're humans. It takes time.
That's right.
It takes time. And so it's really just about identifying the triggers and the stressors, removing them, and then adding in coping skills. And then
because some you can't remove.
Right.
Some are here. They're with us and it's going to be a stressor, but I can help you have more resources in yourself to handle them.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And what is one action step that parents and caregivers just starting out on this journey can take to really build their confidence in handling challenging behavior like biting?
Okay. One easy step to try to train yourself initially is when you have an upset, a conflict, a bite or anything. It can be any kind of hurtful behavior. I encourage parents to step in and say, use an I message. I see biting. I won't let you be near people when you hurt them. You know, you want it to be coming from you. If you step in and say, you're doing blah, blah, blah. Don't do blah, blah, blah. Hey, you know, it's like pouncing on a child and they're going to put their guards up. You want them to be open to hearing what you have to say in a few minutes. So I like to have people step in with an I message. And it also, you just, what do you see? I see grabbing, that's a problem. I see biting, that's not okay. I won't let you near people when you hurt them. You know, what do you see? Just describe it from your point of view. That's an easy way to start using I messages.
That's awesome. That's great advice. Thank you so much. I think that's very powerful. And it's actually part of the framework that I use with parents. It's a portion of it. And I think it's a very, very powerful place to start. Thank you so much for suggesting that. And unfortunately, our time is coming to a close. I know that there's so many more things that we could discuss today. And where can everyone go to learn more about you and your work?
You can go to the website called stopthefightingandbiting.com. I'm in New York City, so that's the time frame. And you can get more contact information from the website in terms of an email and phone number right there.
Okay, thank you so much. And it sounds like you have a lot of great resources available on your website as well.
I try to do that. Yep.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And do you have a last piece of advice or words of encouragement to leave us with today?
I would say you can, this is solvable. Don't jump to conclusions. Take the time to really ask the right questions. And every child is unique. Don't let somebody tell you, oh, he's biting because he's teething, or oh, he's biting because of any one reason. It's never one reason. It's always several reasons. And so if you're just focusing on one, it's not going to stop because it's not a complete intervention.
Yeah, it's always multifaceted.
Yeah.
For your unique child.
That's right.
Yeah, well, thank you so much, Lisa, for being here today and taking the time to share all of this knowledge with us. I really appreciate you and your passion that you have for working with parents and caregivers. Oh,
thank you. It was my pleasure.